In the study group I'm in, we are currently reading and studying the book, The Shamanic Bones of Zen, by Zenju Earthlin Manual. The author is an African-American who is a fully ordained priest in our Soto Zen tradition. She trained as a priest at the San Francisco Zen Center. From the back cover of the book, Zenju Earthlin Manual undertakes a rich exploration of the connection between contemporary Zen practice and shamanic or indigenous spirituality. Although my talk is primarily about Zen rituals in Zen, I may veer off the path down a couple of rabbit holes. Zenju has an interesting spiritual background. Before coming to Zen, she practiced both North American indigenous and African-based spiritual practices, as well as Nichiren, which is a Japanese Buddhist sect. And because of her personal experiences in the shamanic traditions, which she also had during her Zen practice, she surmised that Zen Buddhism also must have some shamanic roots, some of which have been lost or buried. When Zen mentioned the spiritual practice of voodoo, my mind went to black magic, witchcraft, and voodoo dolls. Remember voodoo dolls? Those effigies made to look sort of human, and then pins are stuck in them to harm another, or cause them pain, or bring on their demise. Now I know that voodoo is a religious or spiritual tradition that originated in West Africa, in the area now known as Benin. Due to the slave trade and blended with Catholicism, voodoo became the spiritual practice of black people in the Caribbean, especially Haiti, as well as Louisiana. And voodoo dolls, they were actually meant to help people, to help them heal, and to communicate with deceased loved ones. Here's a quote by a voodoo high priest from Louisiana in 2020. This is from Wikipedia. "It blows my mind that people still believe that voodoo dolls are relevant to voodoo religion. Hollywood really did us a number. We do not stab pins into dolls to hurt people. We don't take your hair and make a doll and worship the devil with it and ask the devil to give us black magic to get our revenge on you. It is not done, it will not be done, and it never will exist for us." So back to rituals in Zen. What is ritual? From the Cambridge Dictionary, a way of doing something in which the same actions are done in the same way each time. Examples would be coffee and the newspaper are part of my morning ritual. Or another example, before Zazen, we gassho bow when entering the Zendo. Then again to our place of sitting, turn around and bow toward the center of the room. Then take our seat and turn and face the wall. There are a lot of rituals in Zen. In fact, pretty much everything we do in Zen is ritual. How we enter and exit the Zendo, how we sit, stand, move in the Zendo, how we bow, prostrate, chant, and even how we do Dokusan. This is Earthlin. "For me, following ancient rituals of traditional paths is to walk an age-old path proven to assist people in transforming suffering into awakening. Rituals, done on a daily basis or as part of ceremony, create an atmosphere of touching the bones, something entirely different than rituals used for social order or coercion. These bones," she refers to, "are the link back to older shamanic practices." So how did these rituals become buried or suppressed? When Westerners became interested in Buddhism, they were drawn to its seemingly rational approach to spiritual fulfillment based on personal effort in meditation to reach exalted states, rather than the superstition and mumbo-jumbo of other religions. At least this was how many seemed to perceive it. As some of the Buddhist countries were colonized, they were quite happy to represent their religion the way that the colonizers and these powerful Westerners wanted to see it. In an essay, Norman Fisher wrote, "In Japan, the 20th century saw the advent of a generation of Buddhist scholars who depicted Zen as all this and more. Zen was super rational. It possessed a reason beyond reason. There was also a denial of ritual by some Japanese and Western scholars that occurred in the late 19th century. Interestingly, this view of Buddhism as being rational and sensible was thrown into doubt by later scholars." Norman Fisher again. "Asian Buddhism has always functioned the way religion in the West has, with just as much ritual, magic, and irrational exuberance." And here is Zenju. "Despite these efforts to suppress or remove what I'm calling the shamanic aspect of Zen, we do not have to go far to discover the healing and magical roots of the practice. These have remained despite the denial that there is a need for them. We can simply begin to recognize the shamanic bones within what has been transmitted in Zen practice. In my experience, it became clear to me that chanting, zazen, rituals, and ceremonies, if taken seriously, can strengthen the process of becoming fully who we are against all odds." This kind of suppression can be seen in many religions and spiritual practices when they come up against another culture, especially one that is more powerful or even oppressive. Remember Voodoo? The religion with roots in West Africa, brought by slaves to the Caribbean area, where it was fused with Catholicism. And this was because it was a religion of the slaves' oppressors. The slaves weren't allowed to practice their own religion. One of the ways the African slaves got around this was to fuse their gods with the Catholic saints. I'm sure this tactic has been used many times throughout history. Zenju points out in her book that there has been, historically, much effort and violence, which included the annihilation of African and indigenous medicine people, as well as the burning of witches due to the fear of black magic. When I read this part in her book, it reminded me of a documentary from over 30 years ago called The Burning Times, which is about the witchcraft trials and persecutions that swept through Europe in the 15th to the 17th centuries. 85% of the victims were women, so it was considered a Holocaust of women. Behind these horrible acts was this fear of witchcraft, although the documentary pointed out that most of these women practiced herbalism and were healers. But somehow, they became a threat to the church and to the then medical institutions and had to be basically gotten rid of. It was a very powerful documentary for me. I felt the pain and the horror very deeply. And on reflection of this fear and suppression of practices we don't understand or are threatened by, it's not hard to believe that many shamanic and earth-based religions and practices were wiped out or became hidden. Again, this is from Zenju. Soto Zen is not considered a shamanic practice by many, and it is not generally taught as one. But if you consider the indigenous beginnings of all cultures, it becomes clear there are underlying esoteric, mystical, or shamanic histories to all spiritualities and religions. There is an interesting connection between Zen and Tibetan Buddhism. In the 8th century, Chinese Chan scholars brought teachings to Tibet, teachings that included divination, spells, and the making of amulets and talismans. The Tibetans practiced these teachings for centuries, and Zen, in turn, became infused with shamanic Tibetan teachings. These shamanic bones from this time can still be seen in our Zen practice today. And a word about Tibetan Buddhism. The prevailing religion in Tibet was Bon, before Buddhism was introduced into that country. Bon was associated with magical practices and shamanism. A really interesting book on the topic of magic in Tibet is Magic and Mystery in Tibet by Alexandra David Neal. She was a French woman who spent something like 14 years traveling in Tibet and studying Tibetan Buddhism. This was in the early 1900s. In the book, she recounts the training practices of sorcerers and sages, their incredible psychic abilities, as well as their phenomenal physical accomplishments. It's mind-blowing stuff. I give orientations to Zen practice for people who want to join practice online. And the majority of the half hour or so on Zoom is just explaining and describing the various rituals we do. As I mentioned, how we move and act in the Zendo. Bowing to our place of practice, we're bowing to our place of enlightenment and also to our own Buddha nature. Turning to bow towards the center of the room, we are silently acknowledging the other Zen practitioners and bowing to their Buddha nature. Then when we sit down and face the wall, we are careful to sit up straight with the chest open and the head lifted up. The mudra or hand position that we use during Zazen is called the cosmic or universal mudra. Cosmic because we are holding the cosmos gently in our hands. Our mudra is a touchstone during Zazen and something we can check in with periodically, because what will happen if our minds wander or get lost in thought? Those thumbs will lose contact and move apart. So we stop and reposition our hands. The ritual hand position becomes a mindfulness practice, helping us to return to our body and breath. There is a text called Fuka Zazengi that we chant in English. It was written by Ehe Dogen, who is the founder of our school of Zen. We don't generally chant it here in the Zendo, but always include it in services we do at Zen Sesshins, which are 6 to 7 days in length. In this text, Dogen lays out very specifically how we practice Zazen. Here is an excerpt. At the site of your regular sitting, spread out thick matting and place a cushion above it. Sit either in the full lotus or half lotus position. In the full lotus position, you first place your right foot on your left thigh and your left foot on your right thigh. In the half lotus, you simply press your left foot against your right thigh. You should have your robes and belt loosely bound and arranged in order. Then place your right hand on your left leg and your left palm facing upward on your right palm, thumb tips touching. Thus sit upright in correct bodily posture, neither inclining to the left nor to the right, neither leaning forward nor backward. Be sure your ears are on a plane with your shoulders and your nose in line with your navel. Place your tongue against the front roof of your mouth with teeth and lips both shut. Your eyes should always remain open and you should breathe gently through your nose. Once you have adjusted your posture, take a deep breath, inhale and exhale, rock your body right and left and settle into a steady, immovable sitting position. Think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. This in itself is the essential art of Zazen. The Zazen I speak of is not learning meditation. It is simply the Dharma gate of repose and bliss, the practice realization of totally culminated enlightenment. Most of what Dogen is describing here is a ritual of our body and posture for sitting meditation. But after Dogen goes through all those details of where to place our legs, tongues, hands, and body, he then says that Zazen is the practice realization of totally culminated enlightenment. What does he mean by this? It was Dogen's view that when we sit Zazen, we aren't sitting to get enlightenment, but are already enlightened beings expressing our enlightenment through the ritual of Zazen. This is a quote by Taigen Dan Leighton from his article, A Zazen as an Enactment Ritual. Buddhist meditation has commonly been considered an instrumental technique aimed at obtaining a heightened mental or spiritual state, even as a method for inducing some dramatic enlightenment experience. But in some branches of the Zen tradition, a Zazen has been seen not as a means to attaining some result, but as a ritual enactment and expression of awakened awareness. This alternate, significant approach to Zen meditation and practice has been a ceremonial, ritual experience whose transformative quality is not based on stage of enlightenment or meditative process. So, remember the next time you sit Zazen, you are expressing enlightenment or your Buddha nature through this enactment ritual. It gives a whole different meaning to Zazen, doesn't it? Sitting Zazen as an enactment ritual brings us closer to the ancient roots of Zen Buddhism, as well as to the Buddha. Let's look at some other Zen rituals. Prostrations. These are always done together as one body, marked by a bell. Whenever you hear that roll down on the small bell in the Zendo, it is a signal to get ready to bow together. When your head touches the floor, you lift your hands up off the floor several inches. And when you perform this gesture, you are lifting up the Buddha who is standing on your hands. It is a sign of devotion and respect. I try to remember this when I do prostrations. Kinhin. Zenju describes it as a slow walk of Zazen. It's easy to think that Kinhin is not as important as sitting meditation and may even be seen as a kind of break between Zazen periods, but it isn't. It is a continuation of Zazen, or at least our Zazen mind, incorporated into mindful walking, one half step with each breath. Done this way, Kinhin can deepen our Zazen. And this is from her book. The power of this way of walking is often missed in contemporary Zen centers, where the participants tend to leave the ritual of Zazen mentally and physically at Kinhin for various reasons. What is missed then is experience of moving with the state of consciousness that comes from sitting. This meditation in movement deepens Zazen as a participant in the ritual circumambulate in the Zendo. There is an awareness of the body and how it walks and breathes, an awareness of how pain resides in the body and mind, and how it relates to the simple action of walking. Kinhin is an experience of how movement and action connect to the mind and thus create suffering and or awakening. Chanting can also seem like just another thing to do as apart from our Zazen. But again, we need to bring our Zazen mind to our chanting. The Kokyo, the chant leader, is important in that they set the tone, the pitch, and the tempo of each chant. Zenju writes, chanting is a powerful way to experience oneness. To merge our many voices as one sound is to join together in an intimate way as we do with our breath and sitting together. There is one mind, one heart. The Dahi Shindarani is something we chant fairly regularly, particularly for memorial services for the deceased. Dharanis have a very interesting history. They originated as magical spells and can be traced back to Vedic times in pre-Buddhist India, and eventually made their way into Buddhism via the Vajrayana school and then into China. Vajrayana is associated with Tibetan Buddhism as well as Shingon, which is a sect of Japanese Buddhism. These Dharanis started out as magical spells against demons and spirits. Another interesting feature of the Dai Shindarani is that if you were to translate it into English, it would not make any sense. The syllables used in the chant are for the sound, not the meaning. So if you think that you're missing something when you chant the Dai Shindarani in Sino-Japanese, you're not. Focus on the sounds of the syllables. A subtle nod to the magical spell history is a dedication after chanting the Dai Shindarani when the Kokyo chants, and we have chanted the Dai Shindarani for protecting life. I guess you could call this one of the shamanic bones of Zen. Dokuzan is a face-to-face meeting with a teacher, another ritual. The teacher rings a bell and we go into the Dokuzan room. Before we sit down to speak to the teacher, we prostrate in front of the altar, then do a gassho bow to the teacher. The questions or subjects brought up are related to our practice, which of course can include aspects of our lives as well. But ideally, we bring our Zazen minds with us to Dokuzan so we can be clear, straightforward, and to the point. It's like we bring our Zazen with us into the Dokuzan room. When we are in Sashin, there is a ritual around the wake-up bell, which is rung at 5 a.m. to wake up all the sleeping monks for the start of Zazen at 5:30 a.m. I have done this position myself and always like being alone in the Zendo to perform the ritual before running around the property, making noise, and maybe being silently cursed by people from their beds. This is a lovely description of the pre-wake-up bell ritual by Zenju. In the dark early morning, while aspirants are still sleeping, I slip downstairs to perform the ritual before ringing the wake-up bell. I bow to the han, a wooden drum hanging on a rope. One beat with the mallet. I bow again. I go down a few stairs and bow to a handbell sitting on a small shelf. I carry it with me into the dark zendo. Both hands are wrapped around the bell's handle at the center of my body, near my heart. I walk and bow to the altar upon which sits Manjushri, the god of wisdom, who cuts through darkness. I ring the bell in a cascading motion up and down three times. I bow again and step to the left and walk to the nearest corner. I ring the bell in that corner. I go to the next corner and ring the bell. I go to the next and the next. I am waking up the spirits of the sanctuary, letting the ancestors know we are coming. I am clearing the energy of the space where the ritual of Zazen will take place. I bow again at the altar and ring the bell three times in a cascading rhythm, as it has been done for centuries. And although I have performed this ritual at Sashin, I don't remember any explanation behind what I was doing when I rang that bell in each corner, that I was waking up the spirits as well as clearing the energy in preparation for Zazen. Maybe I just don't remember. But reading Zenju's account of the pre-wake-up bell ritual gave me a much better appreciation and understanding of it. This is similar to smudging, done by indigenous people, or the swinging of a thurible containing burning frankincense by a Catholic priest to cleanse the space. In some African traditions, they use smoking sage leaves and rattles to do the same thing. This clearing or cleansing of the space is an ancient practice. Another ritual that we have in our tradition is orioki, where we eat meals communally out of three bowls. The word orioki can be translated as just enough, meaning we take just enough or the right amount of food to sustain us. This is a practice that Mountain Rain does in the twice yearly session. It is a beautiful practice as well as a very efficient way to eat, and it is a ritual all the way. A drum is beat while one of the tenzos or cooks offers a small tray of food to the Buddha at the dining hall altar. Then we chant together, stopping to open our bowls and set out our utensils. Then more chanting, and at just the right place in the chant, we start to serve the food. There's bowing before and after serving the food. Then we chant some more and together place our spoon in the largest bowl, known as the Buddha bowl, and take our first mouthful. After everyone has had just enough, there is more chanting, bowing, and serving as we pour water for each other, then wash and dry our bowls and utensils and collect the wash water. Only when everyone is finished tying up their bows is there a final chant that officially ends the meal. It can be quite intimidating at first, as there are so many steps to learn with orioki, but once you get the hang of it, there is such a flow and feeling of community. When I was at a three-month practice period at Tassajara, where there are many, many more rituals, if someone happened to drop a chopstick during orioki, they had to stop and place their hands in gassho to signal to the head server, who would come and pick up the chopstick and take it in both hands to the altar, where the chopstick was ceremonially cleansed by moving it over the incense three times. This chopstick, now cleansed, was returned by the head server to the person still waiting with her hands in gassho, with bows before and after. I'm not sure if cleaning of the chopsticks is still being done this way, given the pandemic and concern about pathogens. When I was writing this talk, I reflected how easy it is to take the rituals we do for granted, just going through the motions. There's a real power to them. They not only support our practice, they are our practice. And beyond that, rituals create a sacred space to practice. And because this is Zen, and we practice as one body, this sacred space holds the whole Sangha. We talk about the Buddha body in Zen. This is created by all of us practicing together as one. I remember being at a session at Samashalan, and this concept of the Buddha body was mentioned. It was there that I first really felt the power of everyone, not just practicing together, but observing all the rituals we do to create this sort of energy field that holds and supports all of us. To me, it was palpable. I've never really made that connection between ritual and this Buddha body till now. All the rituals we do in Zen are really important to creating that sacred space. I will let Zenju have the last word. Everything in Zen practice is done through the state of consciousness brought by Zazen. In rituals and ceremonies, there is Zazen. Thank you for listening.